Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can we know what we're doing today that we will regret in the future? There was a time in America's past when many people simply accepted the enslavement of fellow human beings, the violent removal of Native Americans from their own land, and the forced sterilization of people with mental disabilities. It's comforting to believe that the modern moral compass is more finely calibrated than the one our ancestors used to guide their decisions. But it seems likely that our descendants will believe the same thing about themselves when changing times and values cast some of our era's assumptions in harsher light. My guest would argue we owe it to those future generations to identify and amend morally dubious public policies now. Stephen W. Bender is professor of law and associate dean for research and faculty development at Seattle University School of Law. His new book is called Mea Culpa, Lessons on Law and Regret from U.S. History. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You come at this from an interesting position. You assume that at some point, laws and attitudes on a variety of different hot-button issues of our time will change, and you're thinking about those, you know, who do change them and how they will judge the generations that put them in place.
And I come about this from a bit of a selfish origin, and that is I personally write about and talk about and think about a lot of contentious social issues, it struck me selfishly that others in this age of social media have their opinions so preserved in ways that prior generations haven't. And so selfishly, for myself and our generation, I think we all have a stake in figuring out what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong and what is the future landscape, what is the landscape of regret today that future generations will realize.
Has the general tide of things been that when it comes to social issues, that the law becomes more liberal over time?
It varies. I talk about in the book, for example, that the Supreme Court, which is pretty much the final decision maker when it comes to, among other things, the Constitution, has pretty much validated every practice that we would view now as heinous in its day. So whether that's slavery, whether that's segregation, whether that's the Japanese Internment Act, whether that's the internment of Japanese during World War II, whether that's the Chinese Exclusion Act, which wholesale excluded Chinese from emigrating to the United States, all of those were upheld by the Supreme Court in their day. And so the book is directed at judges in particular, but also legislators and really all of us, because all of us have a stake in writing the right script for our generation.
To what extent do you think judges consider the legacy of their rulings every time they come down on one side or the other of a particular issue?
Well, they often do in retrospect, because in hindsight, a number of Supreme Court justices have expressed regret over their rulings in certain cases, whether that's for example, the criminalization of gay sex or Japanese internment or otherwise. But at the time that they do it, I think judges are more concerned with the moment, and particularly in this politicized era where judge decisions are one next voting ballot away from having the judges ousted, as, for example, the judges were in the Supreme Court of Iowa when several issued a favorable ruling on gay marriage. There was an ouster in the voting booth. So I know a lot of judges are concerned about that. And it's only really in retrospect that they realize, you know, how could we have done this and the role that they've played? And certainly politicians have an even shorter view rather than a long view. And politicians are the ones who often make the laws that that future generations realize are heinous.
But even corporations, as you point out, sometimes find themselves needing to make amends for what they realize are past sins.
They do. Probably the most recent example has been a number of businesses, particularly major commercial lenders still with us, that apologized for actually taking black lives as collateral. For as you would today a house or a car in exchange for loans, particularly you know, a number of universities. There's a book written about the legacy in the Ivy Leagues of how slavery you know, helped build those universities. It helped build most of our institutions.
Your focus in this book is on policies that cause people to be mistreated. But such policies are rarely put in place by individuals who believe or at least publicly acknowledge that they're doing this. And an example of that would be like Plessy versus Ferguson. Nowadays, it seems ludicrous that separate but equal conditions could ever exist under segregation. How was this idea, though, promoted by its supporters in the late 19th century?
It was just a continuation. It was of past policies. We had slavery, and then we had black codes, which pretty much retained the social order by keeping black workers tied to the plantation, really with the force of law and forced labor as the enforcers of that. And then society moved to segregation, which without the black codes was another way of sort of enforcing the social order of subordinate roles in society. And a law professor, Michelle Alexander, has argued very forcefully that today's mass incarceration, which disproportionately targets black people, is just today's continuation of policies that pretty much are a connected line. And a similar theme with similar origins of control that date back to slavery.
So I've never heard anyone who supports the kinds of policies that result in mass black incarceration say, we're doing this so that we can keep more black people in jail. So tell us about some of the things we can look for as we put laws in place that would let us know there are some red flags with regard to overall human justice.
So I tried to find a moral compass, and it took several years of thought and research, and I ruled out a number of possibilities from religious texts to international human rights law and looked at history and decided, well, government apologies, official apologies, and a sense of what we all regret in talking to people and connecting that to official, particularly federal government, and particularly congressional apologies, and created a list that included slavery and segregation and lynchings and the ouster and extermination of Native Americans and Japanese internment and the Chinese Exclusion Act and the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, among others, and then tried to draw a common thread from those, which was dehumanization. That in all of those instances, we had dehumanized the subjects, the victims, the targets of those laws. And then I took that sort of moral compass and I pointed it toward what we're doing today, and it revealed quite a number of policies, practices that are fairly ingrained in our culture, in our laws, that we, I posit, are going to regret based on this compass.
One of those is undocumented immigrants and the way that they are treated under current law.
I've written a lot in other books about immigration. When I started this project, I had a sense that our policies of immigration, which have focused on building a border wall to cut us off from Mexicans and Mexican culture on the U.S.-Mexico border, I had a strong sense, though without any without any real moral compass that was based in, as this book created in history, that our immigration policies were going to be the canvas of regret, and I put them foremost in the book because the compass of dehumanization points directly at how we view immigration. If you just listen to, from radio to politicians, And probably the most recent thing is blaming the measles outbreak on quote-unquote illegal aliens. Pretty much every malady and crisis is blamed somehow on immigrants who we are so ready to dehumanize, yet so equally ready to do the dirty work that we're not willing to do.
Why is that term illegal aliens so troublesome for you? Some people would argue it is, you know, technically true in terms of the way we define both of those words, and yet you feel like there is a stigma attached that isn't attached to maybe other terms to describe the same group of individuals.
And there's a series of words that are used to describe undocumented immigrants. Alien, which is embedded in law, in immigration laws, and illegal, and wetbacks, and a number of related slurs that date back to even greasers. I had a book, Greasers and Gringos, about Latino stereotypes a few years back. And relatedly, we could also talk about anchor babies, which is the term of reference that some people use to describe children born to undocumented immigrants, primarily those from Mexico and Central America. And my concern, my fear, is that when you dehumanize people, the same way that we do for homeless people if we call them street trash, and the same way that we've done for other groups, when we call people on death row the monsters of death row, anything goes. When you treat somebody in subhuman or non-human terms, an alien is the embodiment of somebody who's really not human, somebody who's not really part of us, and therefore it doesn't matter what we do to them.
To be clear, by the way, when we go back to this term anchor babies, it's not true now, and I don't think it ever has been, that an undocumented immigrant who gives birth to a child in the United States is somehow protected from deportation, right?
Exactly. There have been a lot of misstatements, even in published books. Pat Buchanan was one of them, where a number of people have simply assumed the parents are going to come in undocumented, drop anchor, so to speak, and then gain access to immediate citizenship and then all of the benefits that go along with U.S. citizenship. And that's absolutely not true. The child will have to wait till he or she is 21 and then petition to bring their parents in. And there's often a long, long line, particularly for Mexico, for family reunification, immigration. So it is definitely not. You would have to have a 21-year long view your immigration plan, and you would not be protected for deportation. And in fact, millions of people who've been deported are parents over the years are parents of U.S. citizens.
So essentially, you would spend the most productive years of your working life not being able to work with legal authorization in this country, even if that were the plan.
Right. And worse than that, you may find yourself separated from your child because the parents might decide that their child, a U.S. citizen, has the best chance for success here and maybe stays with relatives. And the parents try and figure out a way in. And often that's returning in an undocumented way. And that's an unstable family. And the United States has had no qualms about separating families in its immigration policies.
Stephen W. Bender is my guest. He's professor of law and associate dean for research and faculty development at Seattle University School of Law. His new book is called Mea Culpa, Lessons on Law and Regret from U.S. History. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet @ChrisBoydThink.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Seattle University School of Law Professor and Associate Dean Stephen W. Bender. His new book is called Mea Culpa, Lessons on Law and Regret from U.S. History. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Steve, as you know, many people who oppose the presence of undocumented immigrants in this country insist it is not personal, it is not racist, and in fact, that some efforts to prevent unauthorized border crossings are actually designed to protect the safety of those who would cross without authorization. What do you say to those folks?
I say you just simply look at the record of in the first instance, of border deaths. And we decided, President Clinton in the 1990s, that we would arm the urban areas. So we would arm San Diego, Operation Gatekeeper. We would arm El Paso, Operation Hold the Line. We would concentrate our infrastructure on those urban entry points. And what happened? Did it stop migrants? Has anything ever stopped desperate migrants? No. What they did is they took a far more dangerous and deadly route where thousands have died. Crossing in remote areas and really needing the services of a smuggler, which has been a boon for drug cartels now that have entered the sort of human trafficking smuggling industry. And so we haven't ever been successful in trying to stop the human spirit and people desperate for job opportunities when United States employers keep calling as they have for generations. And certainly all we've done is killed people and done that effectively and said, for you, for those of you who are able somehow to make it, we've got jobs for you in the shadows. They're miserable jobs for low pay. And of course, you're always one step away from being deported in an ICE raid. But we've got those opportunities for you if you make it through. And I've argued that that is just that's just failed policy. We have lives at stake, and we have to have a better way of connecting jobs and opportunity for people who have really come for generations, particularly Mexican-Americans who were bracero workers during World War II, when millions came over several years in an agreement and accord between the United States and Mexico government, many coming through Texas, to work in agribusiness and the railroads and other industries that needed labor desperately during World War II. And I've argued that we have sort of that relationship, that good neighbor relationship, and a border wall and the border infrastructure that has never been effective and never will be effective, whether it's to stop drugs or desperate migrants, is a short-sighted policy we'll regret.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Kate on the line in Dallas. Hi, Kate.
Hey. Professor, I'd like to share with you quickly that I am the 68-year-old daughter of a illegal Mexican immigrant. And my mother, fortunately, was born in the States of an American mother and a Mexican father, but raised in Mexico. And they met in Los Angeles, and then that's where I was born. And they raised good kids, and they were very productive. They did catch my father in 55, and we all went back, and he got his legal paperwork. But as an employer and as an adult, I've known many, many, many illegal immigrants who work, who pay taxes, they pay property taxes because they pay rent, they pay, often have fake social securities, not as often now as before, where they hadn't paid employment taxes, got no benefit from them. So I've had this idea, and I don't know how to publish it, but it would seem to me that it'd be so much easier in terms of immigration for all races to document everyone coming in and to give them a path of citizenship and or legal residency in a very simple way, and that would be to give them an authorization to work and to charge a small immigration tax similar to what you're charged for FICA or Medicare. So it's a little fraction, but it's billions of dollars a year by if you multiply it by all the illegal immigrants we have here. And then be able to have a good working society and the money that it would take, the resources to help immigrants of all races, to help them survive and to do well in this country and to improve our country's infrastructure.
Interesting idea. Thanks so much for your call, Kate. What do you think about that, Steve?
And I value your opinion. And certainly there are millions of dollars that are being paid to basically traffickers to bring people across the border surreptitiously if they're able to survive. And it would be far more productive to say, let's take that money. Let us quickly process somebody. Are they coming? What are they coming for? Are they coming to be terrorists? And there's never been shown to be a terrorist entry coming through the U.S.-Mexico border. The 9/11 terrorists all came lawfully to the United States, and a couple of them overstayed their visas. And we can determine that fairly quickly, and we should know who people are, which is one of the reasons I advocate driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. We should have that same sort of registration and know who people are and where they're going. But we can make money from that, and it doesn't have to be going to those nefarious trafficking industries. It's similar in some ways to the move in several states, including where I'm sitting today in Washington, to legalize marijuana, been part of the drug trade from Mexico, and the states deciding, look, let's capture this revenue. There's a better way to do this than people dying in the illegal drug trade, and there's a better way of meeting our labor needs than having people die in the desert trying to cross, because the legal lines are far, far too small. When you're talking about low-wage labor, people always say, go back to the end of the line like there's a line. In terms of the line from Mexico with very restrictive immigration limits that we imposed in the 1965 Immigration Act, there's essentially a line that winds around for blocks, and you're not going to get in for maybe your lifetime unless you have relatives already here and you're at the front of the line. So there really is no line to get into. And so I really agree. The other point that she made is the myth that undocumented immigrants don't pay taxes. What I say to my students is, I say, is there a line in the grocery store in a sales tax jurisdiction, or is there a line at the gas station for not paying the tax on gas? Of course not. It's the same taxes. And how are schools funded? Through real estate taxes. And whether you're renting or owning, you're paying real estate taxes because it's built into the rent. There are so many taxes everywhere you turn where even if you tried to elude your taxes, you're not able to. And most of these workers are being employed by employers who are in turn withholding taxes and Social Security benefits that these immigrants will never be eligible for because they're undocumented.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Jim on the line in Benbrook. Hi, Jim.
Hello. My question is regarding population control. How do we control population without controlling our immigration? Because immigration is a primary source of population growth now.
It is, and it's a vexing subject. But how I look at that is that there's no reason that we should sort of cabin off our country and say, all right, that's an issue for the rest of the world to figure out. It's not ours. We're all in this together. And ironically, cities welcome new growth. Cities tout the fact that we're growing. We're growing jobs. We're growing industry. We're growing our culture. But at the same time, obviously, the world is becoming populated beyond its sustainability. And I say that we've got to look at that in terms of global solutions. And particularly when migrants are coming here and they're coming for jobs that need to be done, we shouldn't say, well, you have to die in your quest for that just because we want to sort of we don't want you in our backyard. We've got too many people here already.
All right, let's talk about LGBT issues. There have been a number of changes in the law just over the past couple of decades that have changed the fates of many of these folks, but there are still a lot of people fighting to have, you know, full marriage equality rights and that sort of thing. It's a fascinating case study, though, because there's evidence that public opinion on LGBT rights is changing with remarkable speed, in some cases faster than the law.
There is, and I study sort of when we're trying to figure out, all right, if these policies are the product of dehumanization, then how do you humanize? How do you have compassion and empathy for groups, particularly LGBT groups? And it seems fairly evident that close contact and familiarity is what doesn't breed contempt but breeds humanization. And what's known, which talked about in the gay community as the Portman effect, was the Republican politician whose I believe son came out as gay, and he changed his opinion on gay marriage. And so I agree that public opinion is changing, which is probably why in Washington, for example, it was the ballot box rather than the legislators who are slower to react. But judges across the country have been reacting, perhaps made bold by the fact that they're in increasing company, that are ruling that it's unconstitutional to deny equality of marriage opportunity to people on the basis of their sexuality. And the Supreme Court will hear a case this year that maybe definitively rules on that issue.
On the other side of the coin, we've seen numerous examples that changes in law don't change attitudes. The end of slavery, the end of Jim Crow laws certainly have not eliminated racism. So what else has to happen to usher in different attitudes that we in the future will not regret?
Well, as I discussed, there's really no silver bullet for particularly in the case of dehumanization, for us viewing marginalized, subordinated, dehumanized groups as human. And I suggest that, among other things, hearing the stories, learning their lives. I suggest, for example, in the case of migrants, if we knew more migrants personally, if we knew their stories, why they came to the United States, what their hopes and increasingly their American dreams are about, we would understand them and we would appreciate that, my God, my job search was nothing like what you've gone through, jeopardizing your life to come and work in a field in 105 degrees with little food and little water. And I think we would begin to understand that sort of drive and determination is what can make us great, as long as we don't, as long as we appreciate that more than we have in our laws and our policies.
We have an email here from Hefe who says, I'd like to ask how abortion fits into the moral compass question. Will we regret the dehumanization of the unborn?
So I talk about that in the book. There was another author who wrote about dehumanization, and he posited that abortion is the taking of a human life, and that is actually what we will regret, that we have dehumanized the fetus. And in my book, I think it's much more complicated than that. And I end up, because I particularly review the history of women and women's rights and the control of their body, we used to control their property, and now we try through law and control their body. And what I conclude is that while the dehumanization lens sheds no clear light on the abortion issue, law is much better suited to protect women from sexual violence than it is to control their bodies.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Travis in Dallas. Hi, Travis.
Hi. My question is about factory farming. Seems to me like our descendants will be appalled by this, even probably our ancestors. Does your book talk about this? Do you have an opinion on this, Professor?
Are you talking, Travis, about animal rights in this case?
Yes, just okay. The way they're treated. You don't even have to assign them rights to say that you shouldn't torture them. But yes, that the way that we treat like animals in industrial farming operations.
Thanks for your call.
So good question. My focus is on human policies, but I talk about animal rights, and I talk particularly about climate change and the environment. And in particular, what I have to say about that is that a lot of our policies, for example, how we feel about smoking today, and how we feel about certain other discoveries that cause cancer, a lot of that are technologies that really and knowledge that really only came to light after sort of trial and error and scientific experiments. And it's much harder to sort of predict what we're doing now with regard to climate change and others in terms of the landscape of regret. It's far easier, having looked at past policies of admitted regret of humans, to decide what we're doing wrong. So I'm aware and certainly am sensitive to the fact that particularly with animals, there are a number of things that we're doing that are problematic, but they didn't fit precisely this moral compass. And so the landscape of regret is probably a broader canvas than I've painted here, but there's plenty for us to get busy on as legislators, as judges, as public citizens in the landscape that I did paint.
Do you feel like the political climate today causes issues to be much more polarized than they have been in previous generations?
I do. I think part of the polarization is just the sort of is social media and the fact that everybody seems to know everybody's opinion. I don't think that Congress has given us any leadership in bipartisanship. And we need new leaders, we need new thinkers, and we need bridges rather than divides.
Stephen W. Bender is my guest. He's professor of law and associate dean for research and faculty development at Seattle University School of Law. His new book is called Mea Culpa, Lessons on Law and Regret from U.S. History. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with law professor Stephen W. Bender about his new book, Mea Culpa, Lessons on Law and Regret from U.S. History. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Steve, certainly in order to go to war and fight, at least when we're doing, battlefield confrontations, that almost by definition requires the dehumanization of the other side. Talk a little bit about how we have dehumanized populations abroad in the past and how it has caused us to pursue actions that seem unwise or even immoral when viewed through the long lens.
Well, particularly when you're talking about war, one of our first wars against Native Americans, we treated them, and even the Supreme Court called them savages. Also in World War II, we likened Japanese to cockroaches and rats to be exterminated. And so when you have that sort of framing, which we often do in war, it's sort of part of the culture of war, anything goes, and particularly when you're thousands of feet up in the air, dropping atomic bombs that annihilate communities. You don't really have that attachment to that humanity. And I've thought and written about, too, drone warfare, sort of the future of warfare as being particularly problematic because of the sort of detachment and dehumanization between the person pulling the trigger, maybe in some war room, thousands of miles away from the controlled killing drone. So we have much, technology can actually bring us farther apart than closer together in those ways.
So please correct me if I'm wrong. I don't get the sense that you're saying we should never under any circumstances engage in military aggression. But, how can we know when we go to war that we are not inappropriately dehumanizing the people who we have a huge conflict with?
Well, one example is World War II, when despite anti-Semitism in the United States at the time, we took on Hitler and, who was exterminating Jews and gay people and had dehumanized them and even published a book called The Subhuman that was characterizing the Jewish people as basically beneath humans and a danger, a virus that needed to be exterminated. So, certainly in that instance, war was the upshot of it was really a humanizing effect. But at the same time, on the other end of the continent, we were dropping nuclear bombs and killing hundreds of thousands of innocent women and children and civilians. So war is, war is this is a challenge to our policies of humanization. I also talk in the book about the war on terror and how the prerogatives of the war on terror have simply gone beyond to really throw an entire religion and anybody who looks to be Arab or of the Islamic faith, under the microscope and under the accusation of being somehow less than human and somehow being the target of, of surveillance and hyper-surveillance and detention without constitutional protections and a number of other things that we don't even give our death row inmates in terms of rights.
What are the pros and cons of creating protected classes of people to ensure that everybody in this country is entitled to equal rights?
I would say that that the ultimate goal is certainly equality. And in terms of protected classes, if you look at immigration laws, anti-discrimination laws, what I tell my students is everybody is protected no matter what your background. Everybody has a religion or doesn't. Everybody has a race or doesn't. Everybody has a national origin or doesn't, a sex or doesn't. Everybody's got, everybody is encompassed in those laws. And when people are asking, for example, when gay populations are asking for protection from being fired from their job because of their sexual orientation, their sexual identity, they're not asking for special rights. They're asking for the same rights as other people who are heterosexual who are not going to be fired because of that from their job.
Where do you stand on things like hate crime legislation? It's not legal to physically assault another person for any reason. Is it reasonable to add special penalties when the motivation seems to be some kind of prejudice against that person?
I've argued in a different book for hate crime regulation and realized that given the First Amendment, there are legal problems with the recognition of those laws, and so I've created sort of other means, whether it's public protest and gathering sort of group protest against hate speech, because, again, the way that the Supreme Court has interpreted the Constitution, pretty much anything goes in terms of hate speech that doesn't also involve some physical crime associated with it. So if I'm talking on the radio and I'm saying that, as Michael Savage might, that all Muslims and Arabs are subhuman, and that all Mexican immigrants are a terrible criminal threat to the United States, then I'm generally protected under law from saying those sort of wildly hyperbolistic statements that don't also involve some direct physical act of actually shooting or killing the person. The ironic thing is, a lot of times that hate speech really does manifest itself in people who listen and act accordingly. And hate crimes, the physical crimes, have gone way up against these targeted groups in recent years. If you're a transgendered person, you are often the subject of physical attacks and hate crimes that go beyond words. So there is an absolute connection and cause and effect between the two.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Douglas on the line in Sherman. Hi, Douglas.
Yes, good afternoon. I want to go back to judges a minute. You had commented that some judges may skew their decision in favor of getting reelected. Could you comment on how other countries get judges where they are not elected, and whether you think that would be better or worse?
Good question. Well, some of our judges, like Supreme Court judges, are life appointed. And not elected, and I'm generally in favor of that, unless, of course, it's a judge whose decisions are out of line with what I think is with what I think is right. I can say that a number of judges, and you know, are running against some of the same pressures as a politician might. So if you're a district attorney running for office, you need to be tough on crime. And judges who are perceived as weak on crime, they don't get reelected, or they get impeached, like happened to California Supreme Court justices a few years back. And I write about the book in particular about the death penalty, and how I've changed my views over the years about the death penalty. I used to be I used to be somewhat of a proponent of the death penalty, and this book has helped me to grudgingly change my mind, because I now feel that that's on the wrong side of history. But I can tell you, if I'm a judge in an election, or I'm a prosecutor running for a district attorney office, I need to be seen to be elected as tough on crime as I can possibly be, or I'm in trouble at the ballot box.
When you look at the grand scheme of American history, are we generally moving in the right direction?
We are in some ways, but it's a challenge, particularly if you look at our treatment of African Americans. We look back at slavery and we say, well, we don't do that anymore. How heinous that was. How could we do that? But then you have to ask, are things that we're doing now really that far removed? Is our control and incarceration of tremendous numbers of African Americans, is that really different from their control through slavery? And you could say the same thing about women and a number of other of these groups, that we were able to think we have enlightened policies, and they are often connected to a chain of past subordinations. Take, for example, the Chinese Exclusion Act, which wholesale excluded Chinese from even coming to the United States, and they had no chance to be citizens because only white citizens were allowed under federal law at the time. A number of people have spoken that we need to seal the U.S.-Mexico border. We need to cut off Mexican and Central American immigration. How far removed from that is it, or how far removed is that from the Chinese Exclusion Acts, and more broadly, our exclusions of Asians under the Gentlemen's Agreement with Japan and other Asiatic immigration laws. So there's a connection here. Well, we may think that we've made progress, but we may actually only be replicating the same subordinations. And what I say is we have to be aware of that, and we have to really make a clean break from the past. And instead of one step forward, we need to take 10.
If dehumanizing is sort of the common denominator in so many of the laws that we now regret, including those that we have eliminated, to what extent is fear a factor in the dehumanization of any group of people that we somehow define as the other?
Fear is often a factor, and in fact, several of these policies, laws that we regret are ones that arose sort of in mass public hysteria. So a good example would be the Japanese internment policies. There was mass hysteria about Japanese Americans in the United States that had us basically round them up, leaving their property behind, and imprisoned them and their families. And we've since apologized, and Ronald Reagan signed a bill paying reparations for that treatment. So we do tend to do things in the scope of hysteria, but other things that we regret, like slavery, didn't really arise in sort of a climate of mass public hysteria. So something more than fear really has to explain that. And in a nutshell, was sort of economic opportunity and human lives be damned. So it wasn't so much fear; it was just immorality and the economy combining.
What sort of litmus test should we subject new laws to in order to be confident that they reflect our desires, our national desires for justice and equality?
So you think about, what is this law designed to do? Who is it designed to impact? Who does it impact? And you ask yourself, is that a group that we can confidently say society has a sufficient opinion of? If society has marginalized, dehumanized that group, then we got to look more carefully and say, are we really reacting and thinking and acting through that dehumanization, and should we really be doing something different? Would we do something different if we humanize? So, for example, with immigration, I say, look at a family that you know that are your relatives in another state or another country, and you know there's local jobs, and you know that they're desperate for work and hungry, and you have that personal connection. What do you think you would write immigration laws to be if they were denied under current immigration law from coming here and taking those jobs and saving their family and really saving yours? So thinking in those terms of collectivity is a guidance I would use.
Stephen W. Bender is Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development at Seattle University School of Law. His new book is called Mea Culpa, Lessons on Law and Regret from U.S. History. Steve, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate your having me on.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show by sending email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.